Welcome back to Sanity Lounge. Today, we're thrilled to have the incredibly talented bassist Matt Everhart joining us. Known for his unmatched versatility and dedication to the craft, Matt has earned his journeyman status, playing with a range of incredible bands and musicians over the years. From his early days on the scene to his countless gigs that have taken him across genres and stages, Matt's journey is one of perseverance, passion, and groove. Stick around as we dive into his story, his influences, and what keeps him inspired as a musician on the move. And after the interview, Matt brings the low end to Live at the Lounge.
All right, welcome Baltimore. Welcome back to another episode of Sanity Lounge. New guest in this week. Somebody I've met a few times, Matt Everhart. He's a journeyman, a bass player extraordinaire, jack of all trades, and he is joining us in the lounge for a nice deep dive conversation.
And the first official bass player.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've done a lot of drum episodes, but we have not done a just straight bass episode.
Like a lot of
so
pressure.
It's interesting.
Right. Don't worry about it.
But it's kind of up in the air on whether or not I personally prefer a good drum solo or a good bass solo. And I think it's a bass solo.
Yeah. Woe's a rhythm cat at heart. You know,
he's not a musician.
As a matter of fact, 24 years ago, he got a bass and was going to go for it, but then went down the sculpting.
I started playing it,
Yeah.
God damn, I wish I would have.
I knew you were going to say that.
No, I still have it.
Yeah, but I'm saying.
It's never too late, man.
No, I know. But I'll shout out BA here, Brian Applebaum. Yeah. He introduced me when we lived in Florida back in 99 to Victor Wooten. The album Show of Hands.
That would have been about the time I would have found him, too. That was like right at the end of high school for me, before college is when I found out about Vic. So like 97, 98.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, my God.
So, Matt, are you, let's start here at the beginning. Was bass your first instrument?
Technically, my first instrument was clarinet. That's what I played in sixth grade band.
Right.
And then I went through my middle school band career as a saxophone player. But I
love saxophone. Yeah, for the
I was
record.
A tenor sax player.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But I knew that I cared about music even at that age, but it hadn't found my voice or my identity yet.
What
I didn't
city
realize
are we how, in here?
I'm from a tiny little town in North Carolina called Lexington.
Okay.
And so that's where this all took place. If you've ever heard of Lexington and Thomasville Furniture, that's those towns. Like that,
no.
It was a furniture industry.
Yeah.
So there's nothing there now. there's nothing there at all. there used to be furniture. Now there's not.
Right.
But no. So I grew up in that little sort of isolated part of the central of North Carolina. So my exposure to a lot of music was just sort of culturally, I didn't have a big musician in my family, but there was always music playing. I had an older sister. I got a lot of my musical taste kind of passed down from her.
Nice.
But you know, so when I got my start playing any kind of music at all in middle school, I still didn't have a direction. But summer before eighth grade, I had a... So my older sister, again, very influential at this time, was dating a bass player.
Nice.
And I didn't know what the hell that was, but I was already really starting to fall in love with music on a more intimate level. I was a huge Aerosmith fan.
Yeah.
It was a requirement of being in the South in the 90s.
It's got one of the best riffs of all time with Sweet Emotion.
Oh, yeah, man. Of course. Yeah. And not just as a bass player, just like such great, interesting ways to reuse blues harmony.
Yep.
I didn't know that in seventh grade or whatever. But I was already falling in love with bands, right? But I didn't have like my voice yet. Summer before eighth grade, I borrowed a bass from like a distant relative who happened to have one that they weren't using, and did that like the obsession thing. I don't know. Like if pottery maybe was this for you, or
drums,
where you just can't. You don't know why you can't put it down. I was falling asleep with it. I was waking up the next morning. I didn't get any. I was so hard-headed. I didn't get any learning material. I just wanted the instrument. I wanted to know how to tune the strings. And then I was just trying to figure everything out I could. I was trying to consume it by ear.
Mm-hmm. Now, but you did have a smidge of music history.
I did because I was in, right.
So
in
that,
band.
That
right.
does help, dude.
But I couldn't read bass clef. I wasn't even trying. Right. Right, you know. So I had, you're right, I had some musical instincts from
yeah,
band.
Yeah, because I mean, that does help. If you're it going does. In totally it blind, it's a whole other animal. Uh-huh. But,
so,
you know.
Yeah, are you completely self-taught?
I was up until a certain point. So I didn't have my first lesson on bass until I was a college music student.
Right.
I spent high school still playing saxophone for my freshman and sophomore year and playing electric bass for myself. So right. putting together bands, writing music, playing talent shows, that kind of crap. Mm. By the time I was 15, we were like the bands I was in were gigging. This was a different time, right? This was like mid-90s. So there were no School of Rocks. There were, you know, you if you were going to put a band together, you met in each other, somebody's parents' garage,
right.
and you
yep.
learned a couple tunes or you wrote a couple tunes.
And what was your big influences at this particular time?
So I had like a flood of influences that both were very much part of the time period and also the influences of those folks.
Sure.
So not only was I being influenced by Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, but also Led Zeppelin, the bands those guys were listening to,
sure.
Hendrix, you know. And so I got to this point where all of those things had culminated in what was coming out of the bands I was playing with was sort of alternative rock. I guess that's where that led. And then through the course of high school, I started to get interested in stuff that was a little more heady. Found out about Vic Wooten.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Jocko for the first time my junior year of high school. That was a mind blower. And so I started to gravitate away from the pop music, I call it that I was listening to. But at that point, grunge and sure. alternative was popular music, and started to dive deeper. I fell in love with Chick Corea's acoustic band. I fell in love with Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Oh, Billy Cobham.
Yeah. And as I went into college, I realized how much more seriously I wanted to take it. And so once I got to school, I actually got into school as a guitar player because I understood fretboard theory enough and I could actually read treble clef much better than I could read bass clef at the time. And this was 97. So four-year schools didn't have electric bass degrees.
Wow.
It was really Berkeley, BIT in California, mm-hmm. and then you just kind of made your own way if you were anywhere else. And I, you know, all my friends went to like they went to App State, which is part of the UNC school system.
Yep,
so just like a regular 4-year college, they're getting regular 4-year music degrees.
Sure.
And the only way I could get into the program was to do it on guitar. So I auditioned on guitar, got in that way, and then explained to everybody in the school, it's like, there's no reason anybody needs me playing guitar on anything. Like, I'm a bass player. Please let me do this. And they kind of made it happen.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Because you got the best of both worlds. It's like you got the theory, you see how it applies with that, with guitars and everything, because you're right there. Mm-hmm. And
or you know, anything.
Right,
yeah,
right.
I learned, you know, basic piano, and I learned aural skills, and I built, you know, a real understanding of theory, and they just applied it to electric bass.
Right.
And then I did finally have like an actual electric bass professor. His name was Elliot Wadapin, and he was actually with the Paul Winters Consort for a while. And he was one of those guys that was like, actually did a lot of what I do now for a living. He was just a fabulous player that was a hired gun in a lot of different situations. Mm-hmm. By that point, he was teaching at UNCA and playing in the Western North Carolina Symphony. So he lived in Asheville,
right?
Which is what eventually brought me to Asheville. I went to undergrad at App State, which is in Boone, North Carolina. But then I ended up touring with a band out of Asheville for a while as well.
And it's important to see like a guy like that, like the teacher or whatever, actually doing it.
Oh, he was an applied performer. He was
like,
an applied,
you know, because
performer.
You realize, you're like, oh shit, I can do that. Or
he taught in the same way I teach, which is like, okay, you give a shit about this.
Right.
I know enough about it to tell you, give you hints and clues. I've never had somebody come to me and thought, oh, here, let me give you this method of learning how to play the instrument. Right. Not because those things don't work. They do something very valuable, but you don't need me to do that.
Sure.
As a teacher, you don't. Like, what you need from me is maybe guidance on things that if you're headed down the wrong path, or you've got some bad habits or whatever. And then otherwise, it's just talking about shortcuts.
Right.
Ways to master the instrument without the frustration of trial and error. you know, right? Like that's really all it is. Like if you've ever taught drum lessons or anything, anything you guys have done, if you're doing something technical that's related to art, like you, I don't personally ever want to steer anybody's taste or choices in any kind of direction.
I find with the, you know, with drumming or talking, or if it, like a young up and comer wants to learn drums, it's so hard to get them to start at the foundation. And I guess that's true all around because they want to learn this, but if you just learn that, you've screwed yourself. You're totally locked into it. So, like you have to evolve to that, you know? And it's hard to get people to not jump in like that.
I agree. For me, music was always kind of like this cool mystery that I wanted to unravel. Like I had so many colleagues that early on, not now, not my professional colleagues, but my earlier colleagues, high school and definitely during undergrad, that walked away from studying music because they felt like it kind of stole the magic or something like that. And I get that. I get that idea that you want to be surprised or you don't want to be too conformed so that if you're trying to create, you don't feel an urge to follow a certain path. Like you can really, I get that. That makes perfect sense to me. But I never felt like I was losing something by digging deeper into why something worked. Or why a certain interval made me, got me excited, right? Like, why does that create tension? Is it because that note needs to go up or down? And like, we all can do that with our ears, you know, but understanding it from a vocabulary standpoint with theory just turned me on. Just added ones and zeros to all of it. So it was just fun to kind of figure it out.
That's interesting, though. I did read about you. I don't know if this is current. You keep mentioning that you're a teacher. Do you still teach at Carroll Community College?
Not anymore.
Okay. But so you I did rock
for
history.
10, yeah, I did for 10 years.
That's awesome.
Yeah, we're Carroll County boys.
I live out there now. Yeah.
Do you?
I'm in Woodbine, so I'm like.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, this was
close to you.
I'm on Baker Road, man.
Yeah, man. I'm off of Hood's Mill. Like,
that's
you know,
so funny. Man.
That's nice.
My son works at the Winfield Inn.
Oh. That's crazy, man. Well, so the place Chen and I bought when we first moved to Baltimore is by the Liberty Reservoir. I mean, we could like hop on a couple of bicycles and roll there from here. Right. It's pretty close.
Yeah, we know. My family grew up in Liberty Reservoir.
Just like
before
the
they flooded it. Yeah, back in the day. I've jumped off
with the Sasquatch.
Jumped off the bridge. Yeah. We've done some wild stuff. I jumped out of a moving Jeep traveling across Nicodemus Road Bridge.
Yeah, man. I used to take my dog around the reservoir down there in that little area that's kind of an island some of the time, depending on how the water is. Like go out there and hang out and like Jen and I would make fires and stuff. Yeah, I know you're not supposed to. But
so do you teach currently?
I did teach. I don't teach. Well, that's not true. I'll teach on a case by case basis.
Right.
Private
lesson kind
of
thing.
Right. Yeah. Or coaching. I've done some like coaching with groups because when I was at Carroll, which I had a good experience at Carroll. It just during the pandemic, I think anybody in education kind of got fed up with it.
So that's you taught there up till the pandemic.
2 years of the pandemic too. I taught all the way up until the beginning of the.
And you taught
22
music, bass, and rock history.
I taught bass. I taught rock history, and I taught. So I did ensembles. I did the advanced rock ensemble. It was just an audition only rock ensemble, and then an open enrollment rock ensemble. Right. So the open enrollment was more like a rock. You know, like a school of rock kind of thing. We'll come together. I'll teach you how to play these parts. We'll make it through a set of music. Mm-hmm. And then my advanced group was doing like all over the place. I mean, we did everything from like really, really heavy metal fusion stuff to like, I don't know, Hiatus Coyote, you know, like just all over the place. So it was great. It was super fun. I had some great students there. Like you don't really think of Carroll as being like an art magnet, but once that program got rolling, I mean, I had great students come through there.
That's cool.
And I was really fortunate to work with, you know, some folks that are now out gigging that I had as students. So that was a cool experience.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Doing the rock history class was fun too. Like that's doing a lecture.
I was gonna
say,
that seems. That seems like a cool course.
Yeah, well, it's like a real, like, you know, stand up and lecture for 90 minutes
Did you write the curriculum? Did you do the research?
It came with a book.
Sure.
I read through the book and was like, it was so lifeless.
So when was this the book? Do you remember what year was the book from?
Oh, shit. 2003 or something like that.
And you were teaching this
And I started teaching in 2012. Yeah.
So it was missing a lot.
So it was missing a lot. And not just that. It like, I so there is the, I thought this shit was incredibly interesting, just like the origins of the stuff, but it, it gets kind of in the weeds because the real origins of what eventually became rock and roll, you have to look at the origins of American popular music, mm-hmm. which means you're going all the way back to the combination of like the British Isles and slave cultures, mm-hmm. like the, you know, the people that had the least control.
Sure.
They are the people that really pioneered what is a truly original American music.
Sure.
That gave us blues and that gave us jazz to begin with.
Yep.
And then out of blues, we got rhythm and blues, mm-hmm. which is what was appropriated to be called rock and roll. That's that's what it is.
Right.
And so that early stuff, you'll lose a lot of 19-year-olds, you know, if you dig in too deep with that.
So it's such a shame, though, because if they just got out of their own way, there's so much fruit in that. I was such an asshole when I was a kid.
I tried to tie a lot of that back, like, and I tried to make sure I wasn't valuing anything over. And like the first couple of days of class, I'd be like, talk to me about what you actually listened to. You decided to take a music history course at a community college, and clearly you made a decision here.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. And it was cool, man. Like bringing people in and having them talk about something that they're as passionate about as music. Cause almost everybody is, even if they, you know, they say to themselves, oh, I don't care that much about music. You can find something that they hate.
Right.
And you can find something that they love, and you can do it pretty quickly. Yeah. Right. Like, and so we feel a way about music and art, but you know, we talk about music more in popular culture. So it's a little bit easier to converse about.
I'm very heavy on the spiritual side of drumming. It's the mm-hmm. oldest instrument, and it's had a lot of history.
Very human.
And and so, you know, we could get into the weeds about, you know, all kinds of history like that.
Well, yeah.
I feel that you have the same kind of bent of music, just pulling your soul. You can't get enough of it type thing.
Yeah.
It's good stuff.
Any student that I ever had, that, you know, students will do that thing like, oh, what do you think? Should I do this? Do I have it or whatever, you know, however they phrase it.
Right.
And the only answer to that is if you can't stand to not do it, that's why you should do it.
Yeah, right.
If you're doing it because you think you're good at it, like you have no reason to do it, you just think you're good at it, somebody told you it's a good idea or whatever, or you have an inkling that you'd like the attention or you'd like the experience, those will not get you to that point of the thousand times that you're going to hate yourself and then crawl back up to the next plateau and feel a little bit better and hate yourself again and crawl back up. You have to be obsessed with it.
Right. It's so funny. Every gig I'm disgusted with myself.
Right, man.
Every gig I'm like, I played like a shit sandwich tonight.
If you think you figured it out, then whatever you're doing.
With sculpting.
Yeah, right.
Right.
I'm my worst critic.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, this is a pile of shit. Yeah. And my wife's like, you know, it's not. You know, people, like, not everyone can do that. Like,
right. It's a weird thing.
But it's a passion. Like, if I could, I would just create stuff all day long, every day. Like, it's definitely a passion of mine, and it's sometimes it's a problem because I become obsessed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, I know that the problems I have, my mental health problems, both cause me issues and help me as a musician.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
They make me obsess, and that's, I mean, who's going to dive that deep into anything unless you just are obsessed with it, right?
Yeah, my wife, God love her, I mean, she puts up with drumming. I mean, I'm a serious player. Like, I play 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whether it's practice pad or on the set.
I got real lucky with that.
It's like, you know, and my wife, if I don't, she's like, go drum. You're being
or you
asshole.
you need it.
You know, like, it's like, because it's saved my life, really.
Well, I got my wife is a professional player too, so that's a discussion
that's
we don't have to have. Yeah, we both get it for the same reasons. And and actually both of our boys, like if I'm in the studio working or Jen is practicing clarinet, they know that, like, we're at work.
Yeah,
they give us space because we just established that
that's
really early on. Yeah, it's pretty
so
cool.
Your wife plays the clarinet?
She's a classical clarinetist. That's actually what brought us to Maryland. So we got married and went to grad school together. That's when I left North Carolina. We were in the Midwest for a couple of years at Indiana University.
Okay, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Nice.
She got a master's and a performing diploma and then started taking auditions, and she won one of the military groups, one of the top tier military groups based out of Maryland, and that's what brought us here. The one based out of Fort Meade, actually.
Nice.
And we've been here since 2006.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
2006.
Mm-hmm. So as far as your plethora of instruments. How many do you play?
Well,
I know some people are like, I can play a little bit of everything. Yeah, you like can, Ricky's like, I can dabble with
everything. Yeah, you can make noise on a lot of stuff. Yeah.
But what do you got?
So I'm a bass player, you know, foremost, obviously. I actually adore playing drums as well. And I've been lucky enough to have some folks that are willing to let me gig on that occasionally. Right. So nice. I get to do it, you know, I don't know, maybe once a month, something
right.
like that. I play guitar as well and proficiently enough to lay down tracks. I've done a couple of gigs on guitar, but it just, you know, I have this difficulty with my intensity level. And so like the more delicate and sensitive the playing needs to be, that's probably where I falter the most. So I find that the smaller the instrument gets, the less delicate I can be on it live. Like I can sit, play, like I can play mandolin. I can play ukulele. Those things are really fun if I'm by myself and I'm not competing in any way and I'm not getting excited.
It's not
just competing for volume. I get excited and my technique, because of playing bass, I can lean in and the instrument will push back on me. But the lighter, the more delicate the instrument, I start to really choke. And so as live playing guitar is a little tough for me for that reason.
Right.
And then, I mean, yeah, I did play saxophone, but I would never subject anybody to hear me play sax anymore.
Shit, I love sax.
Yeah. So, but I would say those three are things that I would, if somebody needed me to do it at a gig,
bass,
I'd be
drums, guitar.
Guitar. Yeah.
I mean, that's it.
I guess I sing too.
And sing.
Yeah.
It's funny you say about the, you know, like technique and stuff like that, but like, as you know, you don't ever think about it, but part of the gig as you're learning and playing with other people is when something just blows your face off and is just so great, you have to just relax through it. Like as a drummer, if you guys hit a change and the whole band is on point and it's like the lights hit perfectly, everybody's rocking, there's a certain point if you're young in the game where it's like that adrenaline alone will throw you off of everything. And it's like the key is harnessing that like adrenaline pump into stasis or not even allowing it to control you.
And honestly, I think there's value in both of those, right?
Well, yeah, it's like you're looking for that.
Right.
But when it happens, you've got to have the discipline to not let it totally throw you off.
Well, it's okay. Like if your moment of explosion, you're playing a Sex Pistols tune or Nirvana tune, you know, the harder you swing for the fences, the more authentic it's going to feel.
Absolutely.
But if your moment of intensity is some passage in a Tool tune, you've got to nail it.
Right. Like, it's another six minutes of pattern.
Yes.
Right.
And so like those things do matter.
Well, that's what I mean. Like that's a prime example. If you get one of those patterns, right, you do it for 17 measures in a row and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm on. And then it changes to another one. You're like, damn.
I think that's probably the thing I get to utilize professionally the most is conforming to those moments. Because I mean, that really is what I do for
a living. Well, that's what I mean. It's in the young game. Cover the spaces. That's what the problem is.
So you're a lifer. I mean, music is your career. That's what you do for a living. Bass player.
I haven't had a normal people job since summers in between undergrad.
Nice.
The last normal people job I had was working as a third shift manager at a convenience store, like a gas station, because it conformed so nicely with my normal life of playing gigs. And that would have been, 2000, 2001.
Right.
I did work as an engineer. I worked as an engineer, a studio engineer.
Yep.
My undergrad degree was a music industry degree because again, like I said, I was playing electric bass. So I did all my theories. I played my recitals. I did all the stuff, but they couldn't give me a performance degree on electric bass because they didn't offer one.
Right.
So I also did a, business minor and studied in studio engineering so I could get an actual degree. So I did a industry degree with a concentration in recording and then, which includes a minor in business. And then all on top of that, did all of the stuff you would do if you were a performance major, just because that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
So that meant I also worked as a year, 6 months as an intern and then 6 months hired on afterwards before leaving for grad school. I worked as an engineer at a commercial studio. So doing, radio spots, sync to television, jingles, that kind of stuff. I was sitting behind the board
that we would know.
I worked on everything from Wendy's for about a year in there would have come for me. Right. But these would have been regional, though. This was in North. I don't know so how not, far not they ran.
Here, right.
It might have been national. I don't actually know. I was a $10 an hour fucking, you know, even though I was behind the board, they could get away with paying me nothing.
Right,
so
right.
Even though I was engineering, I didn't matter. Nobody gave me any information. But yeah, we had Wendy's. We had Joseph A. Bank. Does anybody remember that version of the commercial?
Yeah.
That guy. I know that guy. What else? What Racing Country, a NASCAR thing. This was Charlotte, North Carolina. Not a surprise. Anyway, that was the national stuff.
Right. That's cool.
Nice.
It was cool. It was good. But I guess that's the last not playing an instrument job that I had.
So you guys moved to Baltimore in 06?
We were in the Midwest from 2002 to 2003, end of 2005. That was grad school.
Right.
I was playing in Indy and Chicago. By the time we left, I was playing pretty regularly in Indianapolis and Chicago. And then we ended up out here in early 2006, and I was still driving back to the Midwest and gigging. Anybody who's ever changed scenes has probably dealt with this before.
Right.
When I left the East and moved to the Midwest, that first year of transition, I was driving back. I'd play like, you know, I'd go up and down the coast with whatever band I was touring with, or go to Winston or Charlotte or Chapel Hill and play the three or four gigs we had lined up. And then I'd go back to the Midwest. And then once I was really working in the Midwest and Jen won the gig out here, I was driving back to the Midwest to tour with that band that I had been playing with for a while, catch the gigs that I had there. And then, so I didn't really start gigging in Maryland till 08, 09.
Right.
It took a while.
Yeah, Kruger told us that when he first moved to Maryland.
Same thing.
He moved to Maryland and then committed to a band back in California. Right. So he was living at the airport, flying back and forth several times a month.
When it's what you do for a living, and it's so even now, even in the social media age, it's still so word of mouth.
Right.
You're only going to get hired if the right person saw you do the right thing at the right time that they think is going to work in this other situation.
Right.
I mean, for those of us who aren't just building their own thing,
right.
You know, at working as a rhythm section player and as a sideman, I kind of just have to go and do whatever I can to sound as good as I can in any one moment, because that's always an audition for the next gig. It kind of.
So do you have an agent, or are you in the union or anything?
I was in the union. For the sake of playing theater gigs when I first got out here, because I was doing a fair amount of theater work in Indy before we left. But I haven't done a ton out here, and I let it lapse, because that's the only thing I've really seen I've needed it for was theater gigs.
Right.
Now, that's not true if you're in New York.
Sure.
You know, that's a whole different thing. But down here, it's not as tightly controlled.
Yeah, I agree. I just thought maybe because you were around, some people, once they get it, they don't let it go.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a little bit of green sheet work, but it's been years since I even dealt with it. But that, I'm not knocking it. I'm not.
No, it's been a long time coming to get you on here. So the first time, I don't know if we actually met that night, but I saw you with the Rachel Hall Band at the Woodshed.
Oh yeah,
because I described it to
you.
Remember?
I
was like, dude, there's a stand up face at this event.
That was a lot of
and
fun. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that was wonderful.
Yeah, the Woodshed's a great place.
Glad you liked it.
Man. Yeah. Because I told him. I was like, dude, it's not every day you see a stand up face.
So I've done the Woodshed three times now.
Have you?
With different groups.
Nice.
Right?
So you're an MVP Woodshed player.
You've done it twice, I guess, with Warren, though, right? Have Speakers of the
Speakers
House
has done, not done it.
They
so,
haven't done
so
it.
So I did it with Warren, with Rachel.
Yep.
No, it's only once with Warren. So I did it with Warren, with Rachel's group. And then I did Dana Denise's, when her album came out, we did a quartet, and it was me and her guitar player, Roxanne, and Sabina on piano. And that was really fun. That was really beautiful.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really cool one.
She's one of on my list to get in here.
She's lovely. And and her creative slant is very fun, because she's got all of this sort of darker, heavier music she's really into, and some really beautiful acoustic bass music.
Yeah.
And she kind of brings it together in a way that I think works really well.
So. She's on the side of Cult Classic now. They have a mural of her.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
It's
and then the third time I did it was a classical thing, and I did it with my wife, Her best friend, John, who's another clarinet player, she's been in bands with in the military band thing for almost 20 years. And his wife, who's a cellist. And we did a classical night.
Wow.
And it was awesome.
Yeah.
So we, and I mean, classic. I was still playing electric bass. But we did some duets. Jen and I did this series of duets during the pandemic. Like we did a version of Black Hole Sun that people like really leaned into. She was playing bass, clarinet, and bass.
Yeah.
And so we did some of those duets, and then she did some clarinet duets, and then John and his wife did clarinet and cello, and then we did quartet, and we actually read string quartets, like legit classical string quartets, but with that instrumentation. So it was electric bass playing the cello parts, cello reading up in the viola range.
I got you.
And then the clarinets were doing both of the two first and second violin parts.
Wow.
So it was really kind of a neat voicing, like the way we kind of combined that stuff. And then what we also did was a little bit of more pop-oriented stuff. Like I worked out an arrangement of a Muse tune that we did as a quartet, Hysteria. And something
underrated
else.
Band. Muse is
badass.
Yeah.
Underrated.
Yeah, I mean, so that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, another thing that seemed like a lot of fun, that the next time I saw you was in June when you put together that like female supergroup at Admiral's Cup, which had Dinah,
Dana,
Britt.
Yeah, you showed me a video of that.
Jess McQuay,
Jess.
Kathy DeToro. She's from Leg Warmers and Fetch.
Nice. Yeah. Kristen Longana.
Kristen Longana, Gina DeLuca.
Gina DeLuca.
it was a million.
Yeah, Kelly Butcher.
Yeah.
Who else?
And what was the impetus of that?
He was all the way in the back.
Yeah.
Playing the bass.
So I have a residency. I know it was all girls and me, right? Okay. Hold on.
It was awesome.
I can explain.
Though,
like, I can explain.
Yeah, I think I left
it's progressive,
here.
Babe. That's
I
what
left.
We're all about.
I don't know who was in that day, but I left here to go there.
I know. You sent me a video one night when we were here, I feel like. Yeah.
So I have a residency at the all the impetus of it was I have a residency at the Admiral's Cup, which is every Thursday. And what I normally do, because there's four Thursdays in a month, I just rotate some of the bands that I play with. So like a Frederick band, and then like I do Rachel Hall, and I do Speakers of the House, and I do a trio with Ricky Wise and Tony Waddy, which is a lot of fun. I really like that one. But when there's a fifth Thursday, I've been making this effort to always do something different. Try to feature people that maybe don't play in that room or even in Fells that often, but people that I really adore working with and admire. And I had this idea. I know so many incredible female musicians in this scene. I mean, we're incredibly spoiled in that way. And every instrument, right? Like guitar, keys, bass, drums, everything. Beautiful vocalists, beautiful. This gig, we had a violinist. We had a horn
it was
section.
Amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah, Nicole Connolly, my friend, trombone player. She kind of led our little horn section, and we had like three horns. It was great. Man. Yeah. We had just like such a great group of people. And so that was the idea. I wanted to feature these female artists, and it was really tough for me to come up with who I wanted on the gig. So instead I was like, well, let's try this. Why don't we build a rhythm section, right? So, you know, keys, guitar, bass, drums, and then whatever we want to augment that. And then we'll switch out the lead vocalists so that we can, you know, move in a bunch of people.
That's right.
And we ended up with what, like 9, 10, maybe 11 people that ended up performing that night. It was great.
I'm
actually kicking around the idea of doing a pared down version of that this next year going forward. Yeah. So it's good to hear that people were into it.
I love it.
And it was
cool.
And the only reason I was there is because it's my gig. Like that's the only, like I didn't need to be there.
Right. No, but it was cool.
It was super fun.
It kept rotating. I mean, it was just a huge band. And then Matt's just all the way in the back. standing there playing
the video.
The bass.
Was
awesome.
Awesome.
It was cool.
Yeah. And we did everything from like St. Vincent to, you know, Motown. Like we were all over the place. It was very, very cool.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it. I'm glad you were there for that, man.
Yeah, it was. Me too. And then most recently, I can't remember the name of the. I just saw you like a couple weeks ago at the Admiral's Cup. Mm-hmm. What was that band?
Tell me what was happening, and I'll tell you what band it was.
It was JK was sitting in with you. Justin Kruger.
That was Dan McGuire's band.
Yeah, that's it.
So the Dan McGuire group, based out of Frederick. I've been playing with Dan for a couple of years, but he's had his band for. I've only been in the band for like 5 years. The band's been together for forever.
Yeah, he's a great vocalist.
He is, and JK was subbing with us.
Yeah,
he sounded fucking great.
Yeah, that was a great night too.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
We went to that.
A great player.
That was after the Be More Art party we went to.
Nice.
And then we popped over there.
Right.
Because then Ricky was playing.
I was saying, and Ricky was right next door something, right?
Yeah. No, it was, that was a great night of music.
So the guitar player for that band, Shelby, he and I are working on original music project together right now. We've got something that we're cooking up. So,
let's go into that, because you're in a lot of bands.
I am in a lot of bands.
You work with a lot of people.
I do.
So let's dive down that rabbit hole.
If someone was trying to seek Everhart, what are they looking for?
You can start wherever you want.
Holy
but
crap.
I know it's deep.
It's a lot. Well, you know what the interesting thing about it is the job's kind of the same all the way around.
Right.
Like you come to the situation. I like different people approach it different ways. I maybe I'll start this, because when we were messaging, I was saying, you know, the idea of being a hired gun is something that I think is slowly making its way into popular culture, or at least they're conscious, right?
Yeah.
Like, we've had movies about it now. We talk a little bit about it. Like, there's internet memes and shit. So,
well, it's funny, because I mean, from his perspective, and I've talked about this with Ricky, I've talked about it with Tristan, as far as from the drummer's point of view, where just filling in, being like, oh yeah, we need a drummer, so you're just going to sit down and play our music. And it fascinates me that that's a thing and you can just do it. But he's like, not everybody really can.
Well, or would want to.
Yeah. Right.
It's an interesting proposition.
But it's something you embrace you do it.
So, and I like to make it clear that I'm not somehow claiming that this is the right way to do it. There is no right way to do it. Yeah. And the people that have been lucky enough to just purely create for their careers, I envy that incredibly. Mm-hmm. I'm not in any way claiming that what I do has more value. It doesn't.
Sure.
But it doesn't not have value, and it's actually really difficult to do in its own set of ways. So it's got value in that. So that's the hired gun thing, I guess, for anybody who doesn't know what that is we kind of imagine professional musicians as either somebody who works as a waiter during the day and plays for free at night, or somebody who is famous and has millions of dollars. We just assume, we don't, but the general public, those are the two versions. It's just like anything else. There's all this mess in the middle. There's work to be played and there's money to be made doing that work, and somebody's got to fucking do it, you know? And so that's what most of us hired gun folks do. I call myself a blue collar musician.
Right.
For a living. I'm still a creative, but mostly I get paid to be a blue collar player.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way I approach that is not the same way some other players approach it. I know some incredibly gifted players who can come in and you never know that they're on the gig because they're so spotless. They have everything incredibly beautifully prepared, and they come and play and leave and you never even know that they were there. And that's really the way they say you're supposed to do it. That's like, the way I was told.
Do you
to do
mean
it.
Never know they were there? As in they weren't actually part of the band regularly? Or,
right. They're subbing, and it feels effortless.
You would have noticed, they're not normally with the
band.
Right,
you're like, that guy must be in the band.
It feels effortless.
No, that right.
And I can do that, but that's not really my strong suit. My strong suit is understanding the material and still kind of playing like me, which I get. But that is a choice that I'm making, which is going to make me the wrong guy for some gigs and the right guy for other gigs.
Right. Sure.
But what it has done for me is allowed me to stay in touch with what I feel like is the creative part of why I play, but be viable as a working candidate for 5, 10, 15, 20 bands at any given time. And those are not like flippant numbers. I mean, there's definitely been times when I've been in bands more than 20 bands, and like you could say I'm in them, whatever. I'm working more than one gig with that many groups, right? And me wanting to still play like myself is kind of the conundrum of that, right? Like, you're going to do all this material that's either oftentimes very different, because if you even think about the bands that I do at the Cup on Thursday nights, like the Dan McGuire group is playing the 90s stuff and the 2000, like the emo metal stuff. And then the second Thursday is Rachel Hall. She does a bunch of her own material.
Yes.
We do a lot of sort of soul and blues. Even her rock stuff definitely has like a, you know, like an older slant to it. Speakers of the House is everything from, you know, like the New Orleans funk stuff we do to Steely Dan to, you know, it's all over the map too. Right. And then the stuff I'm doing with Ricky and Tony, like we're doing Nine Inch Nails. We're doing Ben Folds 5. I mean, it's just a really wide range of stuff. And that's just, those are just the four bands that I work with one night a week during the month, right? You know,
right.
So that wide range, you know, keeps extending out from there. If you look at all the projects that I'm involved in, I work, I'm in Carl Filipiak's band, which is like very, you know, Noti fusion, you know, that all the way to like even like with Dana's project, like it's almost an, a folk group, like from her, her material is much simpler. And I'm really just like kind of warm, low end pad, you know, most of the time.
Laying back.
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place. And that that is what I've done as, to try to sort of create being a blue collar player or being a hired gun, and it seemed to work, you know, like you said before, like imposter syndrome runs pretty strong in all of us. So I hope people aren't just being nice to me and have continued to be nice to me for the last 30 years. I mean,
do you, how often do you get like a call from somebody you don't know?
The out of the blue calls still come. They're never calls anymore, right? They're all messages,
some kind of
DM. Most of them, I try not to lead people on. If I know I don't have time to make something happen, I give them another qualified person's name and try to get them what they need as quick as I can.
But I'm assuming, I guess it's wild.
It is.
I mean, but I'm sure they're reaching out to you either because they saw you or somebody was like, hey, reach out to this guy. It's so many variables to it.
Music is
crazy.
It's so word of mouth. It really is. Yeah.
And there's so much music in Baltimore, many bands.
And badass players.
Yeah. God damn.
This scene, that is something right now that I'm like having a big, like if I was going to proselytize about anything, it's about how incredible the talent pool in the Baltimore music scene is.
Let's hover on this for a second, because when you first came in, you were, you know, like you were going to start talking about the city, and I was like, hold that thought, because I want to, because, you know, we do, you know, we're trying to, you know, bring a better light to Baltimore in general. It's a great city.
It
it's got
amazing.
Problems, but it also has great shit, and it's got great artists and stuff. What is your experience with Baltimore?
So as somebody who's played in more than one scene, more than one major city, and lived there long enough to be at least a working part of those machines, this is such a different environment. It is hands down the most self-supporting and encouraging professional scene that I've seen, because like you can walk out on any given night in definitely in Fells, but also in Canton and still a little bit in Fed Hill, you know, at least the 8x10, right?
Sure.
And here, people of all levels, from really just kind of getting their feet under them to, you can go to Keystone and hear Dennis Chambers play.
Oh my God.
Or anybody you want and play anything you ever want to hear as good as you'll ever want to hear it played. Right. And that's not bullshit. It's just true.
Right.
Right? And so those things are there all the way back down to, you know, somebody who's got brave enough to jump up on an open mic, and people are out listening to it. They're out experiencing it. Now, it's not a perfect world. You still got to occasionally tell people that you don't know what they mean by play something good, but it is not nearly as supportive and inclusive in a lot of other cities. At least my experience hasn't been that way.
Well, that's important to say. I'm glad you said
that. Yeah. And even coming, and like North Carolina holds that pretty dear. The Asheville music scene is very, very tight-knit. Now, I haven't been down there for 20 years, so I'm not a part of it. But when I was a part of it, it had some of these elements, but there was less work.
Right.
There was less money.
Right.
And so it was definitely still more just leaning in on the, I do this as a creative, and then I have whatever I do over here to make a living.
Sure.
You can play in this area if you're willing to do the weddings, you're willing to do the corporate work, you're willing to do the bar gigs, you're willing to play in the county, play in the city, but, you know, go as far as Philly, go as far as south as Richmond. If you're willing to do those things, you can make a living.
Right.
I mean, you have to have the ability to
do
it. Sure, sure. But the work is here, and that's not true everywhere.
Right.
And I think that speaks to the nature of the city itself. People are supporting it, whether they know it or not. Just going out and buying beers at the bar when there's a band playing and not bitching about it is supporting it. All the way from there to, you know, screaming your face off when somebody's playing exactly what you want to hear. Like, those two levels still keep us working. They keep us eating. So it's Baltimore just does that incredibly well. And with great players.
Right.
It's not just a self-supporting scene. It is a very fine self-supporting scene.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. There's the one thing that I've been learning, he's known for a minute now, is like these, like all these bands, I fucking love him. Like, every time he, if he brings a band in here that I've never heard of, it's an original band, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, they're fucking incredible.
That's pretty badass. Did and either of y'all make it to the Almighty Senators
show? He told me about it.
Holy shit, it was so good.
Like, the record. That's not just a one-time thing. Are they going to do it again or no? Or you don't know?
I can't give any kind of official word on that. So you guys
had to have fun.
You know the circumstances, right? That Landis was sick.
Yeah.
Okay, so Landis.
Well, I mean, kind of.
I don't know. I don't know those circumstances.
I don't want to dig in too deep.
Yeah, right,
I don't know how much of that is personal.
Sure,
I know personal information because of knowing Warren.
Sure.
So I'm gonna walk the line on that.
Absolutely.
But getting past what Landis was dealing with.
We at Chris Schaefer's variety show back in July, Landis was there. He's been to two of them.
And so I walked right up to him and said,
Brian
sir,
got a
will
chance
come
to
on
talk
the show?
To him. He wants to come on. We haven't worked it out.
You'll love it. He's such a badass dude. Just and it's not just that he's a character. He's also loving and
he seemed very
incredibly
warm.
Sweet.
No, I mean, like I said,
I'm,
I walked
I'm
right
real
up to
bummed out
nice,
I couldn't go to that know. Because the last time I saw Almighty Senators was on Halloween at the Wrecker.
Okay.
But like 15 years ago.
Yeah. So whatever Landis is dealing with, aside, this particular show, he made the decision that he wasn't going to be able to play drums and sing. Mm-hmm. So he sang on the show and they had a drummer come in. Actually, the guy from Future Islands. It's pretty badass.
Hey,
the
I
drummer
know.
From Future
yeah,
Islands.
Yeah.
He follows us.
I was just saying, we know this guy.
He follows Sanity Lounge.
Crushed that gig. So he was a fan.
Sure.
I'm getting this all secondhand. Anyway.
Sure.
No, that's awesome.
But so he would like that was very mutual. It was a lot of mutual love.
No,
and the band was on fire. They were incredibly intense, incredibly up, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
They played they had a 2.5 hour show. Maybe it was long. It was awesome.
Were you there?
Yeah. Oh,
it was packed. It had to be packed.
It was sold out.
People have been waiting for that show for
well, that's what I said. You
time.
Told well, me about it.
Ricky
yeah,
and I
couldn't do it.
Ricky and I, knowing, you know, Ricky and I both been playing with Warren for years.
Sure.
That was both of our first time seeing the Senators.
Yeah. I've only seen them once, and it was 15 years ago. Like, I'm bummed I couldn't get that.
Right.
And I love, like, Warren's one of my best friends in the world, and getting to see him in that sort of element that is his most natural
origins.
It's just really incredible. And
that's cool.
Their songwriting is fun. And
they're so
badass.
I love that. Yeah, I love the Senators.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
That's amazing.
I saw Ricky
another
post
example
about
of a great
that.
Baltimore band.
Well, right. Yeah. And Landis is doing music like aside from that, right?
He's got a DJ
and
thing.
Right,
He's still very involved. He did auction off his drum set. So I guess the idea of him singing and playing is probably in the past, health-wise.
Sure.
But I don't think he's done being an artist.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's the only reason I can't say whether or not that was a one-time thing. I actually don't know.
I know. Right?
Does that make sense?
I just asked anyway. I didn't think.
I didn't think
we were going to get an exclusive on that
one. I just don't want to put my foot in my mouth, which just wouldn't be the first time I'd done it.
He'd be like, asshole.
So, but just to be clear, you're a hired gun, so you wouldn't call, you don't have the Matt Everhart band that you would call your band officially.
There's a couple things. I would never do that. That's the grossest thing I've ever heard anybody say ever.
I love it. It's going to be the Matt Everhart
band. The Matt Everhart band.
For
Matt
a while at
M-E-E
the Cup.
Quartet.
At the Cup at some point, there was like a like one of those standing chalkboards for the days of the week, and they wrote in the bands, and they put Everhart Salad up there for my Thursday nights, which I was like, God, it's fucking awful. And then it kind of grew on me, and I liked it. And then it got erased at some point. Right. But
Everhart Salad. That's
Everhart Salad.
But no, so if I had, like, am I in some bands? Yes. I am in Dan McGuire's band. I'm in Speakers of the House.
Okay.
I'm in the Rachel Hall band, you know, things like I'm in. Carl Flippiak's band, like those bands, I am the
officially
bass player.
Officially, the bass player. Right.
Nothing is my band because is mine.
But that's just what I meant. Like, is there any bands that you would call technically, like, it's not you're a hired gun, you're the bass player, that
right?
And you're saying that those four.
And the hired gun thing for me has definitely been like the way I've gotten my foot in the door with all these people.
Right.
Well, Speakers of the House was different. That was kind of built because the drummer at the time who put the group together, Christian, wanted a very specific thing. And so I was playing with him and Brian Sims in Junkyard Saints, which is Brian's original music. Another longtime Baltimore
I know that
band.
Name.
But wait, it's Speakers of the House. Are three of the members of that band, you included, in the Rachel Hall band?
Just two. So
you and Warren.
Me and Warren. So the me, Warren Bowes, Brian Sims from Junkyard Saints, and now John Tamakis is our drummer. It had been Christian Stengel.
So the dude that played at the Woodshed with Rachel Hall.
That's Frank Young.
The drummer.
Frank Young is in Carl Flippiak's band. Okay. And so
what was that instrument that he played on?
Cajon. He played Cajon.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, so you had a stand-up bass then.
I played upright on that
game. Right. Nice.
And that I played upright on one of the songs on Rachel's record, too. But I don't do a ton of upright. When I play with Gina DeLuca and Tristan, actually, we have a trio called Naked Amongst Friends.
I love that band. He told about that.
Yeah,
but Tristan was the one who was talking you up about, because he said you use the bow.
I do.
You call it
your distortion pedal.
Your distortion pedal on the bass.
It's fun.
Because you used it on that night at the Woodshed with Rachel Hall.
Awesome. It's fun. Like that instrument for me, I came to it very begrudgingly.
Right.
So I was an electric bass player, right?
Sure.
Imagine asshole teenage anybody but me. You know, and I'm like, this is what I do. And fucking, don't tell me. I don't want to play upright or anything. I want to play electric bass.
Right.
So I pushed back. I mean, I was learning it. I had to learn it, right? But I pushed back against it really hard for years and years. I played it in high school, junior and senior years, just so they could make me stop playing saxophone, which was a good thing for everybody.
Right.
And then kind of abandoned it. And then came back to it in the last couple years because I decided I wanted to be able to make music on that instrument. So playing it with Gina, is really cool because she does a little bit of rockabilly stuff, but she's also doing like rock tunes and singer-songwriter tunes, and I'm getting to kind of play bass, but just on the upright, right?
Yeah, that's fun.
And
it'll help your technique overall. Like, you know, that's good.
So and then I play it kind of punk rock.
Right, So how, from explaining it to a non-musician lad, how different is it playing like the electric bass and a stand-up bass?
Okay, so the stand-up bass is very physical. It's just more muscle in both your right and left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Of course the positioning is different, right?
Right.
That doesn't mess me up that much. That's mostly the same, the positioning.
I guess you just rotate.
Rotating. Of course, unless you're playing fretless, electric bass has frets, and upright bass, you have to find the pitches.
Yeah, listen to that. Think about that.
That's kind of why I was asking that.
I remember watching, Mandy, Scotty's ex, had a cello a lot, and occasionally we'd come across upright basses, and she would start doing the formations of the notes or whatever, and there's no like fretboard. It's like if you're holding an electric bass, there are lines, there are dots. You at least have a little bit of a...
This is like
you have to know on the neck where that tone is and just get used to it.
And I always... I played fretless. I really love... Actually, used to... I was such a fucking nerd.
Right.
Every gig I brought...
Nerd alert!
I was a six-string bass player. I feel like I'm like...
Nice!
It's like Confessions. Right. So I was I was exclusively... God, I was obnoxious. I was exclusively a six-string bass player. So every gig I brought a fretted and fretless six-string bass. Mm-hmm.
That's
every gig for years, like freshman year of college through like, I don't know, the first time somebody yelled at me in Maryland to not play a six string bass somewhere in there, some amount of years. That's all I ever did. And so I played a ton of fretless. And so finding pitches on it wasn't like, it is still tough because the scale length is different.
Sure.
Right.
But that wasn't foreign, at least.
I got
the concept of that.
But you did have a fretless for a minute
for years. Yeah.
Right. So that
makes a difference. Yeah.
But
I still like, you know, intonation is one of the great, you know, offensive things about trying to get better at upright. It's tough. You know?
Right.
Intonation's tough.
Right.
That and just powerhousing that instrument over top any kind of like pop setting, like real, like loud backbeat drum set or loud guitar. It's hard to get an upright that loud because they'll feedback pretty easily.
Right.
And so you're really muscling.
Right.
The
I feel like you have to do that to play it fast. Mm-hmm. Like the strings are bigger, right?
Oh yeah.
Gauge isn't bigger.
No,
they're
not necessarily. They're longer. The scale length is much longer.
Yeah. But the strings aren't really bigger.
They're not really bigger, and they can be, the tension feels heavier.
Right.
Maybe depending on the type of string you use.
Yeah.
But if you use like, you know, like if you ever hear about like bluegrass players, they say like gut strings or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Those synthetic strings feel less tense.
Oh yeah, right.
You know, so there are options to make it not feel that way. But traditionally, you know, a still wrapped upright bass string is stiff and it's work.
Yeah, I always feel like it's like full hand.
It is.
Like,
and it's hard to have really low action on upright and get a lot of volume out of it.
Yeah, well, I guess they're spread out a little more too.
Yeah, the scale length is a little longer. The width between strings, yeah, a little bit. And there's a lot more radius to the fingerboard typically than electric bass.
Yeah, and like you're saying, that low end is very hard to get a pop. It's like,
boom, 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 boom. Right.
It's like, even if it's ballsy in the room, it's hard to get it.
Yeah.
Picked up or something.
Yeah, definitely. You have to muscle it, or at least I do. Right. Like, you know, if, you know, when you guys have like a real bass player on here, like Jeff Reed or whatever, he'll be like, no, upright's really easy and I'm really great at it, because he is. And
I would say you're a real bass
player. You're a real bass player, babe. Yeah.
But as an electric bass player, faking it on upright, those are my.
We're going to find it out at some point.
Did you ever hear of Schlejo? There's a band from Vermont called Schlejo.
I don't know that band.
Actually, maybe Massachusetts. Clinton, my buddy Clean Tones, he's yelling right now. But Schlejo had an upright bass. They were a jam band.
Yeah.
I think I've heard of them, but I don't know if I've heard of them.
But they had an upright bass.
Soul Coughing, that's almost all upright.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Is it really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, go back and check those records out. You'll hear it as soon as you're thinking about it. As soon as you're
right
listening
now that
it.
You know, right. I guess the
oh, you'll hear it.
It just has a little distinguishable sound.
You know what is the da 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 ba da da boom 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 boom. That's the Super Bonbon, right? Yeah, like that's one of their hits. But that opening line.
Now that you're saying upright bass. That 100% sounds like an upright bass in my head right now.
There you go. I figured that'd get you there.
You're a Steely Dan guy.
I am.
All right, good. So Donald Fagen did a couple solo records.
Yep.
I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Not as much as I am. So Nightflyer.
It was called Kamakiriad was the second one. And I was going to ask you a question. The bass on that album is just incredibly I think it's a fretless bass. I don't know shit. I was just going to ask you, like, what kind of bass is he using?
Well, you can pop quiz my ears if you want to play some of it. I don't know that record.
Yeah, well, that's all right.
I did not dig into his studio or solo stuff. And then when they released Two Against Nature, was that 2000 or 99? I got 99. Back into Steely Dan.
Oh my God, I love Two
Against Nature. And of course, everything from the 70s was huge.
Well, know this. If you ever have the time, Fagen solo.
Second solo record.
Both of them. I mean, Nightfly.
Nightfly, I've heard tracks on.
Here's the thing. Nightfly is kind of dated, sounding.
Mm-hmm.
But musically, it'll get you there. There's a couple songs on there that are my shit.
Mm-hmm.
But Kamakiriad was a concept album about a future car. The future where, like, he bought this car called the Kamakiriad and women take over the earth, and like it's a concept album.
Okay.
And it's a great
is there
album.
Like video along with it or
no,
just
no,
music?
No, 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 no. It's just music and liner notes.
Well, this
and
would
stuff.
Have been 93 or it's earlier than that? In the
80s?
No,
80s? No, no. This was 92 or 3.
92 or 3. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it's
a great album.
Okay.
And
I
it
feel
sounds
like
classic
you either,
Steely.
You either love it or you do not.
I think that if you like Steely, you'll love it.
Yeah.
Like, because Becker plays on it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm like, you know, it's Steely. It's
I mean, I like concept records too. Like, that Sturgill Simpson, the fire and.
Yeah. Tommy Simbazo talked about
it. I was saying, we just were talking about it. Is that who brought that up?
Yeah, Simbazo. It's Mushrooms that watches
Fire and Fury? Is that what it's called?
Fury and Fire and
that's
Fury.
Something like that. I'm terrible.
Yeah, talk amongst yourself.
Look it up.
It is Fire and Fury shit.
Yeah.
So, whoa, Davis, do you...
go ahead.
Do you... Well, so wait. All right, so let me think here. Musically, are we where we need to be? You talked about your bands and future projects galore. Now, one thing I usually do... Which
Sound and Fury.
Yep. Thank you.
Sound and Fury.
Oh, that was would have driven me crazy.
Are you good? Like,
I'll segue into this. So we've been talking. Something you were talking about just reminded me of this. So you know what I watched this weekend, because people we've had, we've talked about it like four times on the show, and I haven't seen it in a long time. And I revisited it, and it did not let me down with Spinal Tap.
Oh, my God. One of the greats, dude.
I don't know what was... You were talking about two bases, and Harry Shearer... What's his character's name? Is it Nigel?
Nigel.
No. When he has
right?
the double...
Nigel Farage?
Is he Nigel, or is Christopher Guest Nigel? But the booty song... That they did.
Big Bottom. Yeah. It's unbelievable.
So that's, you know, one of those like ultimate music, you know, constant things.
Oh, it's been at least three people have mentioned that in their top movies. Yeah. And I haven't seen it.
Nigel's Christopher Guest.
Yeah.
I knew he was
Harry Shearer's name?
Shearer is, why isn't he on here? I got Michael McKean, Christopher Guest.
But that I haven't
Derek
seen that movie.
Smalls.
Derek Smalls. Smalls. I haven't seen that movie since the 90s, at least.
And Reiner's deadpan documentarian
so
is
great.
Phenomenal.
Really good. It's so great. And Harry Shearer's not necessarily my favorite character, but his persona is my favorite. Like his outfits,
it's perfect.
The double neck, the giant double bass that he plays, and he's so little.
It's perfect. Along with Michael McKean,
it's amazing.
Right, height.
So, with that being said,
right. So, we usually like to.
I had to talk about it. I wrote it down today. I got to talk about Spinal Tap because I watched it over the weekend, and I actually fell asleep during the end credits.
Oh wow!
And when I woke up, Train Spotting was on, so I watched that next.
Dude, Train Spotting.
Oh it's been a while since I've seen that too.
That feels like an evening, like sophomore year
I
high school.
I think I was
like
dreaming
out with friends.
Right. My wife and Garrett and Amanda were at a soccer tournament, so it was just me and Lincoln home. Lincoln, I think, was probably. I mean, this was late, like probably 1 a.m. because we watched John Wick also.
Nice.
John Wick 3. We're going through that series, but. I think I was having weird dreams, and when I woke up, it was because Trainspotting was on. Yeah.
Dude, Trainspotting is an incredible film.
All right, so keep going.
So we're movie people here, Matt.
Okay.
And I like to get, you know, just a little bit of like, if you have a top three favorite movies, it doesn't have to be exact, but, you know, if you can narrow it down, what would your top three favorite movies be?
I'll make a disclaimer that I usually don't have favorites of anything.
I dig that.
Because that stuff,
it's constantly changing. Yeah, I'm the same
way. My favorite movie I didn't even mention on the first episode.
Right. It's like, it's an unfair question. I get it.
There you go.
Right.
So I'll grab stuff that I watched too many times.
Gotcha. No, that's good. It's like,
it's a personality. We want to get to know you.
So one of the first ones for me was Dazed and Confused.
Oh, yes. We saw it opening day. 93,
saw it a lot.
I was just a little too young for that. So by 95-ish, it was like me and all my sophomore of high school friends. Right. It was like we'd watch Dazed and Confused and listen to whatever record we'd listen to. They would all smoke pot. I was a square. I'd smoke pot.
Yep.
But I was a drunk.
Right. You said I didn't do drugs.
I was
just
a southern boy.
Drunk.
Yeah, I was a southern boy.
Alcohol is more intense drug than
alcohol is way worse of a drug.
It's a way worse idea.
So you were a little harder.
Yeah. So Dazed and Confused would be on that list.
It deserves
a spot.
I love that.
Fuck, this is tough. Okay, I'm gonna just say because it was so valuable during the time, the Lord of the Rings franchise. And not because the movies, I had already read the book, was already kind of a nerd.
Right.
Yeah. And then they all came out in mid-December, and my birthday is the 19th. So I went to see all those in the theater.
That's
like
fun.
A birthday hang.
Yeah. It's an event.
It was, Jen and I were dating. It was like young, early 20s, just like a really awesome time.
And every movie's a
banger.
And they're
fucking crushing.
Right? You're like, damn.
They're great movies.
Right, right. Yeah.
So that's got to hold a spot for me. For
absolutely.
Sure.
Those movies and the Harry Potter movies are fucking me up time-wise is how long ago they came out.
It's
like really like messing with my brain.
Dude.
Well, try having kids and they're like, is this from the 1900s?
Right.
Fuck you. Fuck you.
I have been saying that lately.
Yeah, it's funny now. Yeah,
I'm
over the pain.
I was born in the 1900s.
Yeah, it screws me up.
Lord of the Rings franchise. Those movies I could watch anytime.
Yeah, I think that holds a spot.
Yeah.
Dazed and the LOTR trilogy.
What's your favorite out of the three, if you had to pick one?
I don't accept the question. Don't answer that.
Okay, let me rephrase. I don't have a favorite movie out of the three, but I do have a favorite battle, and it's the Battle of Helm's Deep.
Yeah,
I swear to God,
because it's you're waiting for it.
Yeah.
from the entire first movie, especially if you know, if you've read the books, like, how are they going to do this? How badass is this going to be? I actually was surprised that all the visual stuff for the final battle in Mordor was as over the top as it was, because I don't remember, like, when you read it, it doesn't read that way. I mean, yeah, there are descriptions of stuff, but it's way more character driven.
You're talking about in Return?
Yeah, in Return of the King. That feels like they went hyper cinematic with it, right? Which I get. Cool.
Right.
Really psyched to see it in the theater. When I rewatched the movie, I'm like, eh, okay, whatever. I don't give a shit. Right. But Helm's Deep, absolutely. Yeah. Like, such a great battle. And it's so the first real peak and trough of the series. I mean, yes, whenever they finally make it to Rivendell, that's got like a bump to it.
Sure,
too,
but
Helm's Deep is like, compared to Helm's Deep.
Massive. Yeah. Massive. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I love that battle. Helm's Deep.
So, not a favorite movie, but that's definitely my favorite.
But the
I
two
just
towers
watch that.
Out of those three, when that was coming out, I was pissed drunk as a child, so I did not read The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
My first experience, my wife like read.
Okay.
She can speak Elvish, for fuck's sake. Like, she's read the Silmarillion and all of them.
I never read the Lord of the Rings books.
But when I went to see them as the years went by, she was always like, now this one's good, this one's good. And I was always like, she was like, I loved the book Two Towers, but I don't think you'll like it. And I went to see it with that attitude, and I was like, holy shit, this is the best movie I've ever seen in my life.
No, I'd say like, Two Towers is like, definitely like The Empire Strikes Back. Of the
yeah, like it really it's, sold it's, me, it's and great. Then it made Fellowship better, and then, you know, but I mean, this is 20 years ago. Like, since then, I never even saw
the old cartoons either, but I always did, one of my favorites was the Hobbit cartoon like the early 80s or something.
It was like 70 minutes.
But they had a Lord of the Rings
they did.
Animation style like
but
that,
but they didn't
too.
Finish it. It only makes it up to when Gandalf comes riding to Helm's Deep. Like, you know, on Shadowfax, that whole... God, we're such fucking nerds.
I love it. That's why we do it.
Shadowfax, I love it.
Go so that cartoon version ends in that at the top of that climax.
Yeah.
And they never finished it because it wasn't popular enough.
That's what Paige always said. Paige is always like, she loved the cartoon, but it's frustrating because...
I mean, I can't remember the animator, but he's like... famous. I mean, people know who the animator, but I always loved The Hobbit. Like, I used to watch that with my mother, and she used to scare the shit out of me, which I think I talked about on later. Because she used to pretend she was Gollum and be like, my bread. When I was a kid. Because, I mean, I was probably like 7, 8 years old when that came out. It might have been even like 1979.
It was, because The Hobbit, I used to watch
but
in
I used to
elementary
love it. I could watch,
school.
I could watch The like, Hobbit cartoon, but I also like The Hobbit trilogy. I thought it was great. They just, but like you said, they just added so much to
from
it.
From what I gathered,
for the film perspective.
The book is a third.
It's like 89.
It's so short comparatively.
Right, and what it seems like they added a lot of stories from the Silmarillion and all other tales of Middle Earth.
Yeah, there's a bunch of character interaction that's not really in The Hobbit.
Right,
yeah.
1977. That's when that,
is that
Hobbit,
what,
The Hobbit.
What
came
about
out.
The Lord of the Rings thing? Was that 80 or before?
The Lord of the Rings cartoon. Yeah.
I definitely didn't see it till high school.
So what? Like, so what was your third one? 95. You got a third one?
Oh fuck! Let me think about that.
1978 was The Lord of the Rings.
Okay, so they did The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings and then stopped. Like, why the fuck?
Well, they didn't finish. They didn't finish Lord of the Rings. I was told it just wasn't popular.
Right.
They didn't get the funding for it or whatever.
Huh.
But I actually don't know. I'm sure Google will tell you.
Right.
You don't have to wonder about anything anymore. Just ask the internet.
Fuck that. I hate these motherfuckers. You got to experience something. You can't just read about it. You have to experience life.
I'm gonna have to read the Lord of the Rings books.
It's worth it.
Yeah.
So for me, I go in these weird cycles with reading. I like won't read it all for like 3 or 4 years. I won't give a shit.
Nah, me too.
And then I'll just get obsessed. Like right now, so that project I'm working on with Shelby, one of his inspirations for the thematic material for the record is the Dark Tower series, Stephen King, which I had never read. I'm a Stephen King fan. Mm-hmm. I read The Stand like in elementary school, which is probably part of what's wrong with me. And I had never read anything from the Dark Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And so since I'm working on this project with him and doing like real collaboration, I was like, okay, well, this is important to the story. I'm going to dive into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm already halfway through the third book and I can't stop reading.
Is like, it the Drawing just, like, of Three?
Obsessed.
Yeah.
I'm on The Wasteland now. Drawing of Three is the second book.
Okay, so I read up to Drawing of Three in the 90s. Like, you know, many
I've
years
only
ago.
Read three Stephen King books. books. I've
which
one? Pet Sematary.
Okay.
I read that in sixth grade, which terrified me.
Yeah. That,
I've read Pet that. Sematary. I read Christine, and I've read The Green Mile, because The Green Mile was released in the miniseries.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where you could just
That was awesome.
Books. That was great.
Once a month, they'd release one chapter, and it was it's like a 40-page little book.
Yeah.
One a month.
Another book series that I've...
I changed the subject.
No, what we do, baby.
It goes back to kind of film-ish,
but as
The Wheel of Time.
Oh, yeah.
I've read book one and book two at least four times each, because I read it, then I get through it, and then I stop, and then I kind of forget about it, and then I go back to it, and I read it all over again, and now the series... I've only seen the first season so far, and it was fantastic.
So my wife's been telling me to dig into it, and I've never...
Season one...
I've heard Wheel of Time. Many people have...
But there's like 15 or 16 books. Like, I mean, I think Robert Jordan died at like book 11 maybe, but he had already been unhealthy, so he's got somebody finished the series.
Posthumous work of some kind. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you this.
The first season is great.
Did it get renewed?
Yeah, I mean, their season two's out now.
Oh, okay, nice.
Season two just came out in September, I think,
I will tell you this. If you go to read The Lord of the Rings, and maybe you can speak to this, but Paige always said that, like, it's very heady. Like, it's almost like...
Oh, yeah.
It's like there's languages that aren't English, and there's glossaries for the language. So you're reading, and you don't know what words mean.
They don't always translate the Elvish, but you don't... Right. I never looked up any of it. You can take... Right. You can take
My wife is a nerd.
In context.
So she... No.
Has
will,
she read The Wheel of Time?
No. Okay. I'm talking about Lord of the Rings. You had said that you might try to read Lord of the Rings. I'm saying just be patient with it.
It's really the first... anytime they dip into history, because they'll go, it's actually like reading the fucking Old Testament.
Right. That's what she said, the Bible. Yeah. It's like reading the Bible.
They list this person's name and their lineage and how that worked and who they were related to and why this matters. And then you flip and there'll be like a map of Middle Earth, and they just talked about all these places.
This is during the
And
reading.
You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Not like at the back.
Yeah, no.
You don't reference
in the book.
It. Like it,
yeah, this is in the
you
book.
You go through.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple points at where they're talking about... Middle Earth geography, and I'll flip back to the map and be like, okay, is that north or south?
Right.
Just to get my brain wrapped around.
Right. I mean, how long does it really probably take you to read the book?
You know what? There's another one I was obsessed with, but it's like 1,200, 1,300.
I'm telling you.
I mean, Christopher Lee said he read it every year.
It's a big book.
Like,
and
every
I,
year
like
he
I said,
would read the,
now
the,
Paige,
read the Lord of the Rings.
Paige is a little like, she reads all contracts, she will read every single nook and cranny of everything.
Right.
But it's, it's a read. It's a challenging read. But go for it.
Maybe I'll do it on audiobook.
Well,
actually,
kids
no.
Do
no,
it
no,
all
no.
The time.
So
I mean,
what
it's
I
not like
No,
you,
actually
you know.
I have thought about this. Andy Serkis reads the audio version of it, and he does all 128 characters.
Oh shit.
Cuz it was on like Conan or Jimmy Fallon somebody and they were asking him, they're like, "How do you keep the character straight?" And he was talking about it, cuz it's Andy Serkis. I mean, he's like the GOAT. But he talks about like where he puts the mic when he's doing the character. That determines like how he does it. Like when he's Gimli, like he'll get under the mic.
Yeah, so he's
when he's Gandalf,
smaller,
like he puts the mic down, and he's like, I distinguish myself between all the characters based on where I move.
That's
the
an
mic.
Interesting technique.
But he reads the whole book and he does every fucking character, and I bet he does Gollum pretty good. That was stupid.
You said that. I love this.
Okay, now back to three.
Oh god damn! Third I thought movie. I was going
right.
to go.
You
ahead.
Had all this.
All right, let me think. I have to think of something that actually matters. Oh fuck, man.
Lord of the Rings matters.
Yeah, it did.
So does Days of Confused.
Yeah, Days of Confused mattered to me.
We talk about important stuff here.
I'm trying to move forward. Let's think about stuff that's happened. You know what I'm going to say, and this is again a cop out, but it's for a reason. There's a handful of the Pixar/whatever movies that are incredibly valuable to me, and that is because of being a dad.
Sure.
And so I'm going to lump the first Cars movie.
Yeah.
Because that was like a home repeat with my boys when they were little. And it's a good movie.
Yeah. Right.
But also incredibly emotionally valvable. I felt like Soul you know, being about a musician and about not reaching your goals and all that shit. That was pretty heavy. And the boys, you know, they live with two parents that play music for a living. So that was that sparked interesting conversation.
Yeah. How old? So you have two boys.
I do. So my oldest is 13 and my youngest turns 11 on the 16th of December.
Nice. So I'm going through life at exactly the same pace as you are. My oldest is 13 and my youngest is 12.
Okay. You know what's up.
And they're cool. So I'm not a I'm an artist. My oldest son is an artist. Uh-huh. He's applying for Carver right now.
Right on.
But he's
fucking incredible.
He's an incredible artist. He's a flutist. Flautist. He plays the flute. And my youngest is he's the snare drummer. But they're both in the school band, which is good. I mean, they go to St. Ursula over in Parkville. It's an award-winning band.
Yeah.
But they thoroughly, Garrett really enjoys playing the flute and art. Like, I mean, he's incredible. So he's a soccer player also. He broke his arm back in October in the midst of needed surgery, plates, right arm. He's right-handed. Panic sets in because he's literally working on his portfolio for Carver.
Right.
Just discovered he could draw just as good with his left hand as his right hand.
Left hand. He's showing on the text thread. Yeah. We're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, so he's back. Like, he's still got a splint on because he doesn't see the doctor till December, but he's doing the final piece of his portfolio is the self-portrait, and he's doing it left-handed anyway, wearing his sling. Look, and even though he doesn't have to, doing parts of like the shading and stuff he'll do right-handed, though. But he's
That's slick.
That's a good idea.
Ultra talented kid, man.
But also, I love anytime the creation of art is part of the art. I really enjoy that.
Yeah,
that matters to me.
Yeah, talking about the movies, watching them with your boys is like me and my boy. It was a thing. We'd go see the Marvel movies. Like anything that came out, we'd me and those two would go see it.
Sons are 24 and 18.
Yeah. Okay,
and like they're my house was movie. Like movies are very serious in my house.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like I took my boys to see all that stuff.
Yeah,
and
it's awesome.
You know, it's good stuff.
Those memories will always be with me for the rest of my life.
Hey, let me ask you this: it might have been Pixar or Disney, but it wasn't. I don't think it was Soul, but it had to do with music, and I want to say it was Spanish.
Sing?
And the guys, the guy died, and it was fucking beautiful.
Coco,
thank you.
Coco.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Maybe. Was it that?
It's Coco.
I mean, it was incredibly
moving.
Yeah,
there's a
ton.
That is, so the main character in the underworld is a musician.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And Soul, that's John Baptiste, right?
Yes.
Like yes.
Is he the voice or just does all the music?
I think he's the voice of the main character.
I'm pretty sure you're right. And that's another reason why I love Despicable Me, too, because of Pharrell's fucking soundtrack
is
so good.
Also, those movies are brilliant.
They are. They really are. I like all of them.
Yeah,
I'm just kind of bummed out. Apparently, they're not bringing his brother back because they couldn't figure out how to like incorporate him back into the story because it was kind of like a
Drew.
Off the wall. Yeah.
Well, what are they on? Five or
four? I think. But Drew, I just know Drew is not going to be in the franchise anymore.
The last one felt like it capped off the franchise because so they have that scene. Y'all saw it.
Yeah. I don't know if I saw it.
Well, maybe that's why they're not bringing him back.
There's a scene at the end in the Supermax or whatever, and all the previous villains are singing together.
Yeah.
It's like it's like a cast recall.
I got you.
And I got this. It felt like a
cathartic
end of the series, but I mean, whatever. Sure. If they can make money, they'll do it.
I saw with Quentin Tarantino, like his favorite, you know what his favorite trilogy is?
Tarantino's favorite trilogy, no.
Toy Story. Even though there's four movies.
Yes, because he said the third one is the perfect movie.
Perfect ending. He's like, why the fuck did they make a fourth one? He's like, I don't even care if it's good.
He refused to watch the fourth one because
Toy Story 1, 2, and 3 are the perfect, it's the perfect trilogy.
That's funny. Well, that's Tarantino.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And I believe him.
Yeah, me too. Well, do you have anything you want to plug? Yeah. I mean, like what?
Yeah, sure. Man, I'll just talk about a little bit of the stuff that I have coming, that's coming in this next year. A little bit of things that just happened. So Rachel Hall released her first record earlier this year, which is For her, I'm not sure where that is in her discography, but for us as a band, it's our first, our debut record as a band. It came out great. Warren Bowes on guitar, Frank Young on drums. Nice. Really, really fun record. And I like the way that went, so check that out. And then in the new year, two projects that I'm really passionately involved in, one of them being Speakers of the House and the other being this thing with my friend Shelby from the Dan McGuire Group. So Speakers of the House, we're actually going to go in December, record a little bit of our original material, which not a lot of people know because the band works a lot, but not in that setting. And we're going to release either one or two tunes, depends on what we get done in the studio, just as a kind of a teaser to get people interested in that band as an original music band.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Then the plan to sort of flesh out material that we've already started working on for a record is our 2025 plan.
Yep.
So that band should have something along the lines of a full record sometime mid next year.
That's exciting.
Yeah. Awesome. And I love that band. That band is, that's Brian Sims on keys, Warren Bowes on guitar, and John Tamakis on drums.
Nice.
And then my, friend Shelby. So the reason I just keep saying his first name, his last name is Ab, but I'm, he is probably going to use his mother's maiden name for this project. So it'll be Shelby Waters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I'm there's a thing there. He came to me, a brilliant musician, young guy, 28, fabulous guitar player, another great blue collar,
right.
Regular working guy that, if anybody calls me up and needs somebody, I would give him his name. I'd give them his name in a heartbeat. But he came to me, he's like, hey man, I wanted to work more on creative material. I've got this really ambitious project. I think I want a collaborator, somebody to help me, you know, kind of guide me through the water. And what he came to me with was an entire album of material he already had written. And it's really good. It's concept related, but it's still just some great songs, really fantastic guitar playing.
Right.
And the personnel we're pulling in, I'm excited about. One of those people is Ricky Wise,
nice.
Both on drums and we're gonna use him on some vocal material as well.
Incredible.
Yeah, it's underrated, incredible everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we're both pooling resources, the folks that we, you know, already have, like we said, there's just really high caliber musicianship in Baltimore. So that, album is coming together. The demos, we've been just fleshing out arrangement stuff on the demos. That stuff's almost done. We will probably be finishing up the lyric portion and actually going in to record within the next few months.
Nice.
So that's
nice.
that one's right at the front for me, at least as far as things.
And what
I'm
would that be
about.
Called? You're saying it would be Shelby
it'd probably
Waters?
Be under his name.
Gotcha.
That'd be my guess. Yeah, it's in its fledgling as far as this is new material that nobody's heard.
Right.
Right. So once we get done with the recording process, then we put together a band to perform it. Based on the people that end up playing it on the record, hopefully. And then once that has momentum, it'll, you know, like all things do, you'll work it around in the various places mm-hmm. that stuff belongs.
Right, and, right. That's awesome.
And try to see if anybody wants to hear it. Yeah.
Cool. So make sure you subscribe to the calendar. What's happening in Baltimore? You'll be able to find where Matt's going to be playing, what any band, any of his projects will be on there.
That's the hardest thing about which selling yourself.
I mean, right? I'm gonna have to rely on you to feed me that information, and I'll tell you how to do that.
Right, we'll put up all 70.
Yeah,
events.
But most importantly, subscribe to the calendar. We also, if you go to sanitylounge.com, and at the top there's Your Baltimore. That's just a band, business, artist directory where you just put yourself up there. You can put a link to a website, phone number, any way anybody wants to get a description of yourself. It's almost
very
like
cool.
A bio, and that's just a free
we're trying
directory,
to build that
but
network.
Then so we'll feature events. We send out weekly email blasts on Tuesdays of what's going on everywhere. So
very
like
cool.
I mean, I have like Ricky Wise trios on there for the Admiral's Cup every time.
Yeah, we want to get it to, so if you come to the city, you can text or
go to
what's
Sanity Lounge, and that's where you find out what to do. And we have two big sponsors, right? Or not sponsors, supporters, Guilford Hall Brewery and the Brass Tap in Baltimore. Yep. So they got a lot going on, and we're just trying to gain momentum in the city. So subscribe, share what
awesome.
We're doing, and that's it.
Yeah, man. Tell your friends that we're good people, and we just want good for the city.
Yeah, we'll have you back.
And one of your 70 bands will be in here.
Yeah, we'll bring some
months.
Folks in for sure.
Good stuff.
I love that plan.
I appreciate you, man. Good
glad to be here. Glad you guys are doing this.
All right, stay sane, Baltimore.
Yep. Awesome.
That was fun.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, Baltimore. You can find us at www.sanitylounge.com or on Instagram at sanity.lounge.
Keep listening and subscribe.
Stay sane, Baltimore.